For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really excited that we can spend today's program exploring a problem that a lot of us probably have scant awareness of, but it is really worth talking about. And that problem is that of NFL cheerleaders being mistreated in one way or another, or disrespected. As a matter of fact, more than a third of NFL teams have been sued by their cheerleaders. And this problem is being sort of brought to new light in a couple of different ways. One of them is with a brand new play commissioned by the theater department at Carthage College, a play called The Handbook by Laura Shellhart. And that play is going to be opening this coming weekend and running the following weekend as well. And a documentary film has been made about this issue as well, a film called A Woman's Work, The NFL's Cheerleader Problem. And that is a film that right now is being shown at the Milwaukee Film Festival at a couple of different places, including the Oriental Theater. And it's being screened on the Carthage campus today at 12 noon. So to talk about all of this, we have three guests in our studio today. Neil Sharnick is a member of the theater faculty at Carthage and the director of their production of The Handbook. With him is a junior theater major named Ella Spolstra, who is a member of the cast of The Handbook. And we're also really honored to have with us Wee Gu, who is the director of the documentary film that we were talking about called A Woman's Work. She has made a number of different films, including Who is Arthur Chu? And this film that we'll be talking about today is actually, can I say it out loud, is going to be on PBS next year. If I'm not supposed to say that, then I'm sorry I said it. But
it's all good.
Yeah, very good. So anyway, it's a film that you'll eventually be able to see on PBS, but again, can see today at 12 noon in the Neiman Theater on the campus of Carthage. We welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Ahead of us talking about specifically this theme, Neil, I wonder if you could say a quick word about this exciting thing, the new play initiative at Carthage, which has been such an exciting undertaking over the last few years.
Yeah, it has. This is the 11th installment in our new play initiative, where every year Carthage commissions a new work by an acclaimed playwright, and we develop it from the ground up. We identify playwrights we want to work with, we want to collaborate with, invite them to work with us, and look for playwrights from whom we anticipate a project and a play that will be exciting for the college community, that will provide new new learning opportunities for our students. And then each year we've submitted these plays to the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival and have regularly brought our play. So this gives our students the opportunity to travel a show as well, which we're always excited about. But each one has been unique, has brought its own challenges and opportunities. And I'm just really excited. I think it's one of the things that maybe the thing that above all else makes our program really distinctive.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a quick word about how this particular play came into being? Did you just go to her and say, write us a play, or was there sort of a more specific focus right from the start?
Yeah, no, I really like Laura's work, and she was actually a former professor of mine. I took a course with her, a playwriting course at Northwestern, and so I'd reached out to her saying we'd like you to write a play for us. There wasn't any sense of what that play would be at the time, and last spring she called and we talked for a long time, and she had a few ideas that she pitched, three I think, and then after pitching those three, all of which sounded like they had lots of potential, the fourth was, she said, if I'm remembering it correctly, she said, there's something else. I can't get it out of my mind. I think maybe there's a play there. I heard this interview on NPR with this woman, Bailey Davis, former New Orleans Saints cheerleader, and her story and her lawsuit that she's brought against the team. I think there's something there. I don't know yet what it looks like, but I can't shake it. And hearing her, the way she talked about it, and that this story had really resonated with her, had stuck with her, I said, well, I think that's the one you have to write. And of course, there's so much about it that recommends it. It's a play that on one level it's a civil justice. A social justice play and an equality play, and we're excited to tell that story. It's also one that lends itself to the actors that we have. You know, these are all young women in their 20s and, talented dancers, and we have that. You know, we can do that. We can tell that story at Carthage. So I said, let's do it. And then it was in researching for that I came across a woman's work, The NFL's Cheerleader Problem, and reached out to Wigu and Elizabeth I, the writer and producer of the show, of the film, and the rest is history.
Wow. So until Laura Shellhart said something about this fourth idea, did you know anything about this matter of NFL cheerleaders being mistreated?
No, I knew nothing about it. I did, I was aware of a former cheerleader Lauren Harrington, who had brought a class action suit against the Milwaukee Bucks. That's, I think to this date, the only NBA lawsuit that's sort of dealing with the same issues that the NFL has been dealing with, because that's local news. But the larger question and the wave of lawsuits, somehow I'd managed to miss.
As I think is the case with a lot of us, and it makes this film and this play all the more important for us to see. Ahead of us talking about the documentary film, and then we'll talk more about the play, Ella Spolstra, she's the cast member who's with us today. Can you just say a word about what it's like to be part of a production of a play that has just come into being and that has been written, in a sense, especially for you? What is that like as a young actor to be part of a project like this?
Yeah, it's been super exciting. I was there for the first read last year when we had the first draft. Some seniors and then some of us were asked to read some of the parts out loud.
For the handbook?
Yes, for the play right before we had done the casting and stuff. And I knew that one way or another I wanted to be involved, no matter what it looked like. And it's been really cool to see the progression of the script change as Laura's been in the room and heard these lines from real people acting them and seeing the way that it's progressed so that it can tell the best version of the story. It's also been really exciting to talk to Bailey Davis and Kristanna Ware. I got in contact with them back in the spring after we were cast, and I was like, I'm going to just see if they're interested at all in coming out or talking to us or even talking just to me about their experiences. And within days, they were both super on board, and especially Kristen Ann. She was like, I'm coming to see the show. I want to talk to you guys. I want to be as involved as I can. And so it's been interesting to play a real person, someone who's based on someone real. You want to do justice to her story and to who she is. And it's exciting because it feels so much more important that it's about people who are truly being affected by these issues. It's a new experience for me, and it's been awesome.
Wow. Very good. For those of you just joining us, we have in our studios Neil Sharnick from the theater faculty at Carthage, who is the director of this brand new play by Laura Shellhart called The Handbook. And with us, Ella Spolstra, who is a junior theater major at Carthage and a member of the cast of The Handbook. And also with us, and we are so pleased, is filmmaker Wee Gu, whose documentary called A Woman's Work, The NFL's Cheerleader Problem, has garnered quite a lot of attention and praise. It had its premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival. Right now it is being shown at the Milwaukee Film Festival. In fact, later today or tonight it will be screened at the Oriental Theater. But maybe more importantly for WGTD listeners, today at 12 noon in the Neiman Theater, which is on the lower level of the Hedberg Library on the campus of Carthage, it will be screened today at noon for anybody who finds themselves intrigued and would like to see this film. So let's talk about this documentary, which predates all of this. So tell us how you first became aware of some of these stories of NFL cheerleaders and these lawsuits. Mm-hmm. How did this first cross your path?
Yeah, so at the time, I had just graduated from the University of Southern California, the film program there, and I saw an article in the LA Times about Lacey's first lawsuit, which was in 2014 against the Oakland Raiders. She was a cheerleader for the Raiderettes, as they call it, and she was alleging wage theft, the fact that she was paid less than minimum wage for the work that she was doing. So before moving to the United States, I actually grew up in Canada and also was born in China, and I had no idea really what football and cheerleading was until I went to Los Angeles. So as an immigrant to this country, I really fell in love with the world of football. I mean, it's amazing. It's like millions of people participate in this sport and the spectacle of the sport every Sunday and every week. And, you know, it was fascinating to me as an outsider to look at American values and American society and culture through this sport. So when I first heard about the lawsuit, it, you know, really blew my mind because, you know, coming to America, you expect democracy, you expect equality, and this was anything but. So it was a great opportunity for me to look at this, examine this inequality in a very personal, intimate way by following the stories of these women.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really laudable that you wanted to do that, because I think a lot of times when we're really excited about something, like you were really excited about sort of the spectacle and grandeur and excitement of NFL football, and then this story comes up that's a pretty disturbing story that sort of reveals this kind of dark underbelly. And I think a lot of people would just want to shove that away and just keep on being excited. And you were willing to explore that. I suppose that's because you're a documentarian at heart and always probably looking for those kind of compelling stories.
Right. And I think often the best stories come from areas or things where you maybe feel like fearful of, or you feel it makes you feel uncomfortable. That always is an indicator of me of something interesting, compelling.
Right. So what set in motion the process by which you actually put a film together about this story? I mean, do certain things need to be in place logistically, financially, for instance, before it makes sense for you to get to work on making the film?
Right. Well, first of all, it's important to secure access to the people who you want to be in the film. So I contacted the journalist Robin Upkarian, who is a longtime writer for the LA Times, and she put me in touch with Lacey's attorneys in Oakland. And they're an all-female employment law firm. And Leslie, one of the main lawyers there, she got in contact with me. I explained what I wanted to do, and I wanted to meet Lacey. And she said, yes, just drive up from Los Angeles to Oakland. And I met Lacey and the lawyers, and they were all amazing. And the lawyers especially kind of took me under their wing and talked to me a lot about employment rights and workers' rights and all of these things that are so important for people to really know about. And Lacey, too, we connected because we both come from working class families, you know, where our mothers were working full time inside and outside of the house. And we knew what it meant to really have a good work ethic and try to achieve your dream through that work ethic. So from there, I just started filming with her. And because I had been working, you know, as a filmmaker, I had my own camera. So I was able to do that pretty quickly. And I put together a couple of minutes of footage and submitted that to ITVS, actually, which is Independent Television Service. And they had a development fund for diverse filmmakers. So I was able to get a little bit of seed money for some more shooting. And it just kind of grew from there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very good. So what, over the course of what length of time are we talking about in terms of the putting together of this film?
Yeah, so I first met Lacey and her attorneys in 2014, in March of 2014.
And that's when their lawsuit, this lawsuit was sort of launched?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I met them then, and then I met the other woman, Maria, who is one of the main characters in the film, in winter, in like January of 2015.
She's with the Buffalo
the
Jills.
The Buffalo Jills, who are the cheerleader, who were actually the cheerleaders for the Buffalo Bills because they were disbanded after the lawsuit was brought on. And so we filmed for about 4 years with them. Yeah.
Wow. So let's explore a little bit about the kind of grievances that Lacey and Maria had with their respective teams, the kind of ways in which they believed themselves to have been mistreated, disrespected, not treated fairly. What kind of grievances were they bringing to light in these suits?
Right. So for Lacey, she was a new mom when she joined the Raiderettes dance team. She was living in Oakland in the Bay Area with a child. And, you know, she made it onto this amazing team, which was part of her lifelong dream. And she realized, you know, a couple of weeks into it that she was paying for everything. She was paying for, you know, her commute to photo shoots. She was paying for all of her own makeup and beauty upkeep, and there were strict standards that they needed to follow. And she realized, looking at her contract, that, you know, they were going to get paid at the end of the season instead of every 2 weeks as mandated by California law. Now, you know, she has student loan debt, as many people do. You know, she was trying to raise her family. So this was something that was insane to her. But at the same time, you know, again, this was her dream. She wanted to live out her dream. So she felt very conflicted in that moment. And she brought her contract to the attorneys in Oakland, and they looked at it and said, this is the most illegal contract they've seen in the 25 years of their legal experience.
Wow.
Yes. And, you know, this is an NFL team, the Oakland Raiders, that had put this in writing. This is all in writing. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, insane for Lacey, and she really felt like she needed to do something about it. And in talking to her teammates, everyone was also saying, no, this is not right. And then for Maria, it was that, because they were not getting paid at all, actually. They were given two tickets to the game and a parking pass as quote-unquote compensation. But even more than that, she experienced a lot of these sort of unsafe work conditions and just sort of, in a way, abusive work conditions that, you know, most people would not ever want to experience. She felt devalued. She felt humiliated at these sort of weekly weigh-ins that they had to do, where if they gained maybe 1 pound, they would be benched. She was actually benched twice because of her weight issues. So it was really this culture of exploitation that, you know, she really felt wasn't right, and she wanted to change it.
Mm-hmm. With these two particular women, were they, to any significant extent, at odds with their teammates? I mean, were they going it alone? And, I mean, what was the reaction to some of the other dancers, cheerleaders? I mean, did they welcome this attention, or did some of them fear it? Did some of them even resent it?
Right.
How would you characterize the way that they're respective teammates greeted these lawsuits?
So professional cheerleading has been around for 50 years, over 50 years, and there's been this culture of sisterhood and camaraderie and loyalty and being grateful for being a part of this team that has been cultivated over the span of these decades. Right. So when Lacey and Maria and the other women who stood up and said, you know, and sort of revealed this exploitation, a lot of the other cheerleaders, a lot of the other women really felt personally hurt by it in a way, because they felt like this was smearing the beautiful experience that they had achieved in their life and with the sisterhood of the other women. So it was not a positive reaction. Wow. From many people. And even if there were they were supportive of the lawsuits behind the scenes, they were not willing to do so publicly, because there's a lot of pressure and fear and challenges that you face when you come out publicly mm-hmm. with this kind of thing.
Hmm. Yeah. Legally or officially, what kind of employees were Lacey and Maria? Are they categorized in some particular way that would allow, for instance, the Oakland Raiders to, in a sense, circumvent what seemed like very straightforward employment laws in the state?
So they suffered from what is called misclassification. So they were misclassified as independent contractors or volunteers. But when you look at their contract and their handbook, mm-hmm. which is the subject of this play, you can clearly see the level of control that the employer had on the nature of work, on what the actual, you know, stipulations of the work that they had to perform. Everything from their uniforms to the way they compose themselves. And it even goes beyond, you know, on the field. It goes into their personal lives as well. So by all measurable standards, they were misclassified.
They should not have been called independent contractors or volunteers. I mean, they were being treated as employees.
Yes.
And even most normal employees wouldn't be treated the way mm-hmm. they were being treated.
Yeah. For example, if you work at McDonald's, you're wearing a uniform. That alone, in many cases, if you're wearing a uniform, that already just means automatically you're an employee.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. So the your film, which I have not yet seen, but I am excited to see, charts in particular the experience of these two women. When we watch your film, what do we see beyond the spelling out of sort of the legal case that's at the heart of the film?
Right. So the film is the main title is called A Woman's Work. So from the very beginning of this film, I really wanted to delve into not just the job and work of a cheerleader, of a professional cheerleader. I wanted to look at women's labor mm-hmm. overall and the correlations of, you know, devaluation and misogyny and the stereotypes that women face across all industries. You know, even for me as a filmmaker, the film industry is notoriously misogynistic mm. and unequal. So I follow the Lacey and Maria as, you know, their lawsuit evolves, but I'm also following their personal lives because I wanted to find out, you know, how they would sort of rebuild their identity after losing something that has been so core to who they are since they were little girls. You know, and Lacey, for example, she expands her family. She has, by the end of the film, she has two more kids. Mm-hmm. And she felt in many ways, blacklisted from the professional dance world. And she felt like, okay, I'm just going to focus on being a mother. But she realizes that, that's not enough for her, that she wants to still pursue her passion in whatever way she can. So you see her journey sort of falling out of that community and then finding her way back. Mm-hmm. And overall, I think for both of them, they come to understand what it really means to be feminists in a way, mm-hmm. To really fight for women's rights, not just for themselves, but for other women as well.
Mm-hmm. By the way, what do these kind of dancers do at a game typically? I mean, when are they dancing, and are they cheerleaders or are they dancers or some kind of mix of the two? I mean, when it comes to game day, what typically are they doing?
They're doing so much. I mean, you can also attest to it. Like, they start, it's basically a 12-hour day, if not more, for them, because they have to arrive early, they have to, you know, get prepared. Then they're going out and greeting fans, and sometimes in smaller groups, like maybe four women will go out into the tailgates and do a small routine and greet fans, or they'll be in the stands greeting fans or the boxes, and then, you know, they come on in the beginning of the game, you know, onto the field, and as the football players come out, and then they do the main sort of halftime show, but they're also doing each quarter different shows around the field. And, you know, then there's like duties afterwards where they have to again interact with fans. So it's just a full on day.
Right. Yes. That fan interaction, it should be mentioned, often includes selling calendars,
right,
being out peddling their cheerleader calendar with the expectation of selling so many per game. And with some of these teams being told they will not be on the field unless they sell a certain number of calendars each
week.
Wow.
Yeah. Ugh.
Yeah.
And, of course, then rehearsals and other public appearances to the court. So it's a full week of work.
Exactly. And they're mandated to actually do certain appearances by the teams, whether it's for charity or just businesses. And in many ways, like, for example, in Buffalo, which, again, is a, you know, it's a small Rust Belt city, you know, these women were going everywhere into the community representing the team. And, you know, whether it's children's hospitals or, like, you know, the senior center or whatnot, they're in many ways the ambassadors of the team in the community.
Wow. Is it just women?
So currently there's been a couple of men who have been added to these teams. And I have to say, before World War II, actually all cheerleaders were men until World War II, when the men had to go, you know, fight the war. Then they became all female teams. So in today's day and age, now there are some teams are adding a couple of men to these dance squads, but predominantly it's still women.
Right. These two particular women who are the focus of your film, Lacey and Maria, did they, upon the lodging of these lawsuits, quit their teams, or were they fired from their teams? What did their what was their relationship with these particular teams as these lawsuits went forward?
So both Lacey and Maria had already quit their teams before they filed the lawsuits. So they were considered alumni of the teams when they filed the lawsuits.
And do you want to divulge the final outcome of those lawsuits, or would you rather people learn that from your film?
I mean, it's public record. So for Lacey, her lawsuit did settle with the Raiders, and she was able to get financial relief for her and her teammates in the class action. And then Maria's lawsuit, the Buffalo Jills lawsuit, is still ongoing. So it's, yeah, it's been, you know, 5 years and counting.
Wow. For those of you just joining us, we're talking about the controversy that has been swirling around NFL cheerleaders. And just now we've been talking about a documentary film called A Woman's Work, the NFL's Cheerleader Problem. It focuses in particular on lawsuits brought by a member of the Oakland Raiderettes and a member of the Buffalo Jills. But it also speaks to a more widespread problem. Over a third of NFL teams have been sued by one or more of their cheerleaders over issues of inequitable treatment, unfair labor practices, and so on. We're also here to talk about a play that is about to open at Carthage, a world premiere, part of their new play initiative, Laura Shellhart's play called The Handbook. Neil, explain the title.
Sure. For those who might hear about these lawsuits and respond dismissively in any way, have some preconceptions about cheerleaders and what their responsibilities are and what they do, I think the smoking gun in many ways has been the several team handbooks that have been leaked out into the public. The cheerleader handbooks, their guides for everything from their expected behavior to their expected appearance to you know, what they do for the team. These are handbooks that that have become, to a large extent, the frame of our play. One will see projected throughout the play. There are many rules from the handbook that you'll hear and see throughout the play. And I think that if an audience member doesn't know that those are actually taken out of these handbooks, they wouldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Right? It seems like the stuff of fiction.
It absolutely does. The amount of control that these teams claim over the cheerleader's appearance in practice, on the field, and even just out in public. The understanding that whenever you are out in public anywhere, you are a representative
of
the
team.
At any time. There is an expectation for appearance. There are rules about fraternization within fraternization with the players. Rules that first begin by branding the players as predators. You know, these players are predators. They want to prey on you and don't let them. So you have a responsibility to protect yourself. And what that responsibility looks like is you cannot be anywhere that a player is, right? And if you are seen in the same room as a player, at the same restaurant as a player, you will be fired. You know, that will be grounds for dismissal. And
wow.
which means for some of these players, for some of these women, if you're eating at a restaurant and a player walks in, you are expected to get up from the table and leave. Because that is very clearly spelled out. So these anti-fraternization rules all apply to the women, the female cheerleaders. The players have no there's no rule that they are being expected to follow that is commensurate or no parallel. So
they're not charged with keeping their distance from cheerleaders.
Right.
It's up to the cheerleaders to keep their distance from the players.
Right.
So there's a scene in the play in which the cheerleaders are all sitting around the locker room blocking 1,800 NFL players on all their social media platforms because to like or follow something a player posts or allow them to communicate with you on social media creates suspicion immediately. So they are expected to do this. The players are not. The players, I would guess, largely don't even know exactly that this rule exists. So so all this responsibility is placed on these women that not only is disrespectful of their time, of their privacy, but also, as we described, the employer is making an unreasonable claim on control over their private social media accounts, over their appearance every moment in public. And these are people who are being called independent contractors or being called volunteers. There's no way that an organization has a right to that level of control, period. But
right.
Certainly not over someone you're not even paying minimum wage.
Right. It's outrageous. And yet there are enough women who have gone with this, I mean, accepted
right, for
this.
Half a century.
Oh, it's just mind-boggling. Ella Spolstra, tell us about the woman whom you are portraying in the handbook.
Yeah, so Bailey Davis, she was a cheerleader. She was trained her whole life. This was her goal from the time she was a little girl. Her mom was also an NFL cheerleader, so she grew up watching the cheerleaders, watching the games. She knew that this was her dream. She ended up being fired for a photo she posted on her private Instagram, which they deemed inappropriate. It was a picture of her in a bodysuit, and she's actually wearing more clothing in that picture than she wears in her cheerleading uniform on the field.
Whoa.
And they said it was not consistent with their image of their team. And even though it was a private Instagram account, and they said it broke the handbook rules, and so they fired her for it. And she said that was not okay. And so she filed a lawsuit for gender discrimination, and she ended up very recently settling that lawsuit after a long fight. And a big thing that she's talked about is that she doesn't want to have this lawsuit, and the reason that she has it or she had it was because she doesn't want to see cheerleading end. She wants to see the conditions be better so that these girls can still have this dream, that they can be at the top level of their sport. They can be these professional cheerleaders, and that their pay would reflect the level of rigor and talent and athleticism that it requires to be a cheerleader. We've talked a lot about how these women are at the top of their career. If they want to be professional cheerleaders, dancers, this is at the top of your career. I mean, America is so unique with our football and our cheerleading. You can't go anywhere else to be a professional cheerleader, really. And the pay is, it's nothing. And so if the players are getting paid millions of dollars, then that shows a level of respect that you have for those people. You're going to care for those people. But for these women who get paid next to nothing, it shows that they don't respect them. They're not going to care for them. If they get injured, that's on them. If they're not being treated well, that's on them. So Bailey Davis is just, she's awesome. She's on fire about it. And she's still pursuing dance, still pursuing her dream, just in new ways now.
Right. So is this someone you've talked to?
Yeah, we've FaceTimed the cast. I've talked to her a lot over text message and whatnot. We've communicated since back in May, which has been really cool. And she's awesome.
Yeah. She was able to bring a bit more attention to the issue. She and Kristen Ann Ware, a former Dolphins cheerleader, who's also the inspiration for a character in our play, they got a little attention by offering, they share a lawyer, Sarah Blackwell, mm-hmm. and they offered to settle for $1 each mm-hmm. if in exchange for a good faith meeting with Roger Goodell and his lawyers, just the opportunity to make their case and to, because they thought that was the best avenue for change. But that was met with silence, that offer.
Wow.
I have to also bring up that Bailey, because of the lawsuits that happened in 2014, brought on by, you know, Lacey and Maria, mm-hmm. so the St. Stations were actually paid a minimum wage. Mm-hmm. So they were actually getting paid legally. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, maybe when people see that, oh, they offered to settle for a dollar, that means in comparison these other women are money hungry or whatever. But no. It's not about that. It's about the, right. you know, the legal right that these women had mm-hmm. to these back wages and to be valued. So they're both separate things, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Ella, are you portraying her or are you portraying someone who's based on her?
Right. Yeah, that's a super fine line, and that's something I've been really exploring. Because whenever you do a role, you have to put a little bit of yourself into that person. So I think this has been unique. Especially having talked to Bailey, to kind of mesh together, okay, who is Bailey and myself and also Lainey is this one person. And so not at all trying to emulate her or try to recreate her, because you can't recreate a person, but to be inspired by her, to have it be based on her, and to also bring a bit of myself into the character.
Right. So literally, you are not her. I mean,
right.
You're not. That's not a name we see in the cast list.
Right.
And why was that? Is there a legal reason why this can't be more, in a sense, specific?
Well, the first of all, the play was written before we had had contact with these women. So there's that, right? That we're basing these characters on real women who didn't know about the play. But beyond that, Laura's done something I think really clever in that she's created an NFL team. There is a fictional NFL team called the Fury and their dance team, the Flames. And in order to to tell this story effectively and comprehensively, when these women are in fact scattered across several teams, she's created a fictional team, put all these women on one team, right? So they're not Bailey Davis and Erica Wilkins mm-hmm. and Kristen Ann Ware. They're characters whose experiences very closely parallel what happened to these other women, but they're all happening within the fictionalized context of this fictional team, the mm-hmm. Flames dance team for the NFL team, the Fury.
Interesting. Tell us just a little bit about how this play has taken shape between the first conversation to the first rough draft to what ultimately is its final form.
Absolutely. The larger shape, I would say that the changes in some ways have been small. The play itself feels very much like the first draft. It's just been that Laura's been really generous in with her time. She's been a regular participant in the process. She's been there about once a week all the way through. When she thinks a scene isn't working the way she wants it to, she has not been precious with her words. She will just go through and winnow and cut away and revise a scene. There's, I think, one scene that has been was added from the original draft, and one or two that have been cut. And otherwise, it's just been a matter of tuning, right? Figuring out what sounds good, what works, what's most effective, and then a lot of it was the discovery that happens with every play in the production room, where figuring out what the staging looks like, how this is going to be designed, you know, what the set looks like, how you do can in any way replicate the energy of an NFL stadium and that sort of experience in a 350 seat theater. That's challenging. So our scenic designer Martin McClendon is trying to think about how we give the sense of being there when you're in this theater without without 80,000 screaming fans. So the play proposed lots of challenges, but that's one of the most exciting things about the New Play Initiative is being able to be the first to tackle the problems that every play brings. Mm-hmm. You know, for this play, we did it first.
Wow. So what has the experience been like about communicating with some of these women who have, in a sense, lived this? What kind of difference has that made?
Oh, it's been fantastic, and I cannot overstate how generous these women have been with their time and their lives, really inviting us into their lives and wanting to communicate, being making it clear how grateful they are that their story is being told, that this conversation is being expanded. You know, when we talked with Kristen Ann Ware of the Dolphins, not only did she and Laura talk for hours, but she FaceTimed with the team. And I just remember, as that conversation ended, I asked, you know, if any of the cast, if they think of some other question, oh, I wish I'd asked Kristen that. Would it be all right if I put them in touch and they talk to you? And she just said, oh, absolutely. And even if it's not about the play, you know, if you just want to talk, you know, she was just so generous and so kind. And that, to a degree, has been our experience with every one of these women. Even some that we haven't had a chance, but fairly recently gotten in touch with. I've recently reached out to several of the Houston Texans cheerleaders who had brought a suit. One of the Texans cheerleaders, Angelina Rosa, inspires part of the handbook. I reached out to several of them and immediately heard back from many saying, oh, we can't get up to Kenosha, but is there any way? Can we read the play? Are you filming the play? Can we talk to you? That response has been universal, which I think has been really gratifying to Laura and to me, knowing we're telling these women's stories, that there hasn't been a lot of hesitancy or reserve, just excitement that the word is getting out.
Right. Mm-hmm. By the way, does the play touch on what Wigu was saying about her documentary, that there are women in this world who have resented and or feared these lawsuits and have a very different perspective on it? And is their perspective represented in this play, and is it represented, in a sense, fairly?
Well, it's a good question. We don't see any of the alumni community of the team, right? Which is where in the film we have an opportunity to see some girls some of the women in the Raiderette alumni community and in the Jills community, and the mixed messages and the conflicting response to the lawsuits there. What we do see is resistance, particularly from one member on the team, because we're putting so many of these issues and so many of these women who have brought forth these lawsuits together on one team, what it allows in our story is for the beginning of a movement, right? You see all of these women rising up, where in reality, there were class action suits in these 2014 suits. A lot of the 2018 suits, these have been women standing alone on their teams by and large. And what we've been able to do is put them in a community, right? Mm. Take their arguments, take their case, take their voice, and put it with a group of other women who are also upset about their treatment. Mm-hmm. But there has been some, you know, you see the women who are not willing to give it up and who are choosing instead to side with management, to what they see as siding with the team and they see a threat in these women, right? There are those who see it as a threat to what they love and what they want to do. That even the director, who in a lot of our conversations with these women, the director has been the source of a lot of grief. Mm-hmm. Even the director, there's the fact of the matter is these lawsuits can end for her the things she loves the most, right? Mm-hmm. What might happen is what happened with the Buffalo Jills, that the team simply be disbanded and we all lose, right? That's the sense that if you do this, we could all lose. And so sometimes it's those voices inside the organization that provide the greatest resistance, that are the hardest to overcome. Because while you're fighting for them, you know, and there's I think it's Lacey who says sort of a you're welcome at one point in your film, right? Who while she's meeting all this resistance, she wins, or there are little victories that happen. And Erica Wilkins with the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, there have recently been some substantive mm-hmm. changes in how that organization is run. And while she's been very gracious, you know that in her heart of hearts, there is somewhere she is saying, you're welcome. That in spite of your unwillingness to step up, in spite of your unwillingness to side with me, to speak up, to join a class action suit, things are changing. And they're changing because of me, and you're welcome.
Right, yeah. Right. Even though you resented or feared what I was doing at the time, you are reaping the benefits of that, fact that I was courageous enough to step forward.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, especially like nowadays after the Me Too movement, there is actually a lot of pressure on women to speak up mm-hmm. and to stand up and say something. And while that's amazing, obviously, like the women that can stand up and be publicly, you know, fighting for something, that's amazing. And you can join together publicly. But I think also, you know, it's fine to also not, because everyone has a different, you know, set of consequences and situations in their life that, you know, that pressure shouldn't always be put on the women. To do so. I think we as a society, we should also look at the system and the institutions that have created these unequal and exploitative workplaces.
Mm-hmm. Right. So all of this can be explored, of course, in these two different works that we're talking about today, the play, The Handbook, and this documentary film called A Woman's Work, the NFL's Cheerleader Problem. Tell our listeners where they can see this film in the short term.
Right. So the film is a part of the Milwaukee Film Festival. It's going to be screening tonight at 6 p.m. at the Oriental Theater in Milwaukee. And it's going to be screening the next day at 2:30 at the Rivoli, which I don't know.
Rivoli.
Yeah. And also today is going to be on Carthage campus at noon.
Mm-hmm. And that will be in the Neiman Media Theater, which is on the bottom floor of Hedberg Library. I assume that's a free screening.
It is a free screening.
And the public is invited to come see that. I mean, if you can't get there, you'll get to see it on PBS sometime next year. But
yes.
Otherwise, in the short term, this is the way to see this film. And then, of course, the play, The Handbook, receives its world premiere at Carthage. Neil Sharnick, tell our listeners about exactly when and where those performances
sure.
occur.
Yeah, the play opens November 1st. There are performances November 1st, 2nd, and 7th, 8th, and 9th the following weekend, all at 7:30. There's also a 3 o'clock matinee mm-hmm. on November 3rd. And we are very excited to let people know that if you'd be interested in meeting, in hearing from some of these women who are the inspiration for this play. Bailey Davis, former New Orleans Saint Sation cheerleader, and Erica Wilkins, former Dallas Cowboys cheerleader, will be at the opening night performance, November 1st, and former Miami Dolphins cheerleader Kristen Ann Ware will be in attendance the whole second weekend.
Wow.
So come on out, and not only will you have the opportunity to see the play, but you'll get to meet these women and hear their story directly. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. What a thrill. And huh, Ellie Spolstra, you must be pinching yourself that you can be part of this.
Yeah, it's super exciting.
Absolutely. Neil Sharnick from the theater faculty at Carthage, Ella Spolstra, a member of the cast for The Handbook by Laura Shellhart, and also with us today, Wee Goo, whose documentary film a woman's work, the NFL's cheerleader problem, did so much to bring this this problem to light in a very, very different way. I'm so appreciative of all three of you for being part of the morning show today and for telling this important story so eloquently. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I will be speaking with someone who is with the local chapter of Sleep in Heavenly Peace. This is a volunteer group that seeks to try to craft comfortable, safe beds for children in families, in homes where there might not be any safe place to sleep. We'll be doing that tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It's archived at WGTD.org and also available as a podcast on all major podcast platforms as The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. We're approaching 9 o'clock.